Hi, I'm Steve.
And I'm Simon. Welcome to the Business and Beers podcast,
where we chat to our guests about real life experiences and the practical steps to their success, with a ton of knowledge bombs getting dropped along the way.
While enjoying a beer together, don't forget to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. So yeah, welcome to all our Business and Beers faithful listeners. This, I think, has been a long episode coming. I know I've kind of fielded the stalker side there, but super excited to have Alex McPhail. Hopefully I didn't fluff up your surname there this next episode of Business and Beers. And yeah, Alex, I think just your story on LinkedIn, if any of our followers aren't following on LinkedIn, I'd highly recommend them to jump on, because it's just been such an inspirational story. So I'm not going to steal your thunder. Maybe if you can just intro yourself, who you are, and then, if you have listened to some of our episodes, you'll know the curveball comes in. But just what's one thing that very few people know about you?
Yeah, okay. I got that question earlier.
Brilliant.
I could take the Kimi Räikkönen approach and, one or two words. So I spent 10 years in the South African Air Force as a pilot and flying instructor. The last 3 years I spent in the formation aerobatic team in the Silver Falcons. And from there, after I had a 10-year contract, I left and joined South African Airways and flew as an international airline pilot for 12 years. And again, the last kind of 3 years of that journey, I was more and more involved in LinkedIn, the story that you mentioned now, Simon, where I was sharing the insights and just what the day in the life of and various stories, kind of, what we've been up to while traveling, what pilots look for in the night, what a trip looks like, et cetera. And that was a fun story. And it all came crashing down last year during the business rescue and then COVID and got retrenched. And opportunities, well, we had to go and look for some opportunities, but there were some opportunities. And I think we'll get into this, but if you pay attention to the universe out there, when you hear the same thing for the third time, I think it's time for you to respond. So there was a response, and I managed to get involved in the entrepreneurial journey on two different businesses, one being helping out in the courier business with labor, general workers and truck drivers, etc., and another in the digital and telecom space doing customer care work. That's really kind of the journey. And along the way, I was getting involved in public speaking. That was starting to take off when they stopped doing public speaking events, which is quite tricky, and repurposed that into an online YouTube channel and then repurposed that into a podcast, which I suppose that formally connected us, the three of us today.
Brilliant. Yeah, that's super exciting. And I think one thing that not many people know about you, I mean, what's like a surprise thing about Alex?
Yeah, well, I was very, I suppose, I don't know who's listening. So I think most things I'm saying now, people don't know about me, but something that maybe in the last few years, people don't know too much, that I used to play roller hockey. And when it was a thing, in South Africa, rollerblades arrived on the scene somewhere around 1992, somewhere around there, certainly amongst my friends. We were living deep south in Cape Town, down in Fishhook. And the scene was very small, and I think we were involved quite early on from the first Chinese imported rollerblades that we could get. And very quickly we got involved in roller hockey, and we're at the national level playing for the Western Province team and playing in the South African squad. And that took me to both the UK and America playing roller hockey. So maybe that's incredible. Something interesting.
Yeah, that is cool. Alex, so let's get into the meat of it. I know we don't obviously want to harp too much on the SAA story. And if anyone is interested, they can go view your LinkedIn. And Simon always still speaks about the post that you posted around your last day there and handing in all your gear. But what I'm really interested to discuss as we get started is, what were the emotions that you felt? Like you said, there was three signs from the universe now to go from being employed, obviously now going through a restructuring process, to now having to start your own thing. Were you nervous? Were you anxious? Or was it just like fight or flight mode for you?
Yeah, definitely fight or flight. I think, I really was back in the corner. We weren't getting much notice at South African Airways. We weren't unique, the travel industry was probably the biggest hit, and very much in parallel with that would be any hospitality. So anything to do with people and travel, hotels and that whole industry, plus all the ancillary that go with it. So I don't want to point out my lack of fortune in the last while, but certainly there was not a whole lot of notice because we were already in the business rescue process and things escalated really quickly. And, you know, within days we realized we're not going to get a salary again, which is tough when you're approaching month end already. And, you know, so really from my perspective, I was the, not only the breadwinner, but the only income in the house, and that stopped. But, you know, life carried on and expenses carried on. So it was really a I wouldn't say panic, but certainly very much alert and go after something. But after that initial couple of weeks sitting at home where we all stayed at home when the country was kind of on pause, it was just a case of let's go out and do anything. And I was lucky that there was an opportunity. My neighbor had a courier business. And when all those wine deliveries were withheld with the liquor ban, and then all of a sudden they had to be delivered. Remember that everyone that took advantage of those, buy three bottles for the price of one now, but you couldn't get it until the boss said, right, you're allowed to drink again. That's when the business started. They needed people to deliver the wine. And I was employee number one delivering wine. And it was only after the second day where people started reaching out and say, listen, I also want to deliver wine. I had a whole bunch of pilots working for me saying, look, I'm also doing nothing. It's better to just go out there and deliver wine and rather than sitting at home on the couch. So I think that first day I signed on at work with my jacket and my shirt and my reflective high-vis jacket on top at about 7:45, got myself ready. And I got back in that day at about 6 p.m. It was cold and dark by then. It had been a long day. And I think I'd made 280 Rand. Wow. For the day. And it was a long day. You know, that wasn't even a beer in Munich a month before. So it was quite humbling, you know, very, very humbling. But it really was a case of, as your question, Steve, that, you know, go after something because you need to do something.
Yeah. And I was going to say, I think it's kind of like two things there. It's such an unfortunate situation because if you typically had to lose your job and like the industry is carrying on, you know, with the connections and the network you have, it might be fairly easy to like be like, hey, other airline XYZ, like I'm looking for a job. But I think what people don't realize is like literally the travel industry shut. So you kind of have nowhere to go. It's like, you know, one day you've got a job, the next day it's kind of like, yeah. And I think the funniest thing is exactly like you said, I was having a look back at the post and I still made a comment there the day you posted when you joined the courier company. I was like, yo, this is probably the most qualified courier driver that you'd ever find. And it must have been quite strange, you know, getting in the car and not having to do like pre-checks and, you know, these are the exits and this is like the cabin courier. And
yeah, it is funny. In fact, I was speaking to somebody today about a flying job. You're right, you know, and again, it's not only the travel industry that got hit that way, where you lost your job, but the whole industry lost their job. So it wasn't like you were going to get another job elsewhere. So, you know, that became part of the fortuitous part of the story later on. But in the instant, you know, I was chatting to a guy today about a flying job. It's like a first flying job. Get your commercial license, get 200 or 300 hours, and then this is the kind of job you do, flying to lodges in Africa and Namibia and Botswana, etc. And I said, look, you know, I see you're looking for a guy with 300 hours. I've got 8,000 hours and I've flown the latest airliner, you know, would I be eligible? It is, you know, you could be overqualified in some respects, but in another respect, you just bring what you can bring and you can add value wherever you can add value. And I think that's particularly if you look at the pilots, I only speak so much from that point of view because it is my point of view. Typically, pilots found it quite hard to sell themselves in a different industry because, you know, what do we normally measure ourselves by? A little Excel spreadsheet that says Boeing 3,000 hours, Airbus 3,000 hours, total hours 10,000 hours, etc. You divide it down into what aircraft you've flown. Did you fly as a captain? Were you a co-pilot? Have you flown at a major carrier, et cetera? So it's all related to very specific data-driven, I've flown this airplane, I've done this, and I've got these many hours. And there's no description of your skills other than what you've done. It's almost like a summary of experience of flying rather than telling a potential employer or going out there on your own what skills you possess. And I try to share this a lot with as many people as possible at the time that, you know, if you look at it, you've got great people skills, great time management skills, great organizational skills, thorough preparation. People generally in the aviation industry, even in the airline industry specifically, it's to the minute. You know, you don't take off at 10 past 8, or if it's 5 to 8, you get everyone at 5 to 8. If you're landing at 6 o'clock in London, you land at 6 o'clock. If you take 13,400 kilograms of fuel, it's not 14,000 kilograms of fuel. So very specific skills that are there, but because we use it all the time in a very specific context, it's hard to communicate that in another way. So that was really an effort. I put a lot of effort into last year to just say, guys, think a little broader. The things you do every day, dealing with 15 different services. When that airplane parks at the terminal, you know, you're on a tight turnaround from a Cape Town or a Durban, there's about 12 to 15 services that arrive within 2 minutes of parking. You know, it's technician, it's fuel, it's ground crew, it's a ramp agent, baggage, potable water. You know, there's so many things that are going on. And that's kind of a whole skill in itself, just managing so many different entities that come together at one time, knowing that you're on a time constraint. You've got 40, 50 minutes to get out of there and take the next lot of 180 people to Cape Town. So those are the kind of things that I was sharing to just try and get the message out there that we don't talk in numbers of which airplanes you've flown. Now it's what are the skills you used every day to deliver your job?
And I think it must be quite like a big challenge, because exactly like you say, the skill set you've got, now you go to a courier company and like that literally goes out the window, because if someone says like you need the parcel at 20 past 10, there's so many more people than like 15 stakeholders involved in getting that parcel. So I can imagine it's also quite like a shock to the system, because nothing happens on time, I would imagine, like in the courier industry, as much as you try.
Yeah, it was tricky. You know, again, the people in my network reached out, and I think at some point I had 4 or 5 pilots working in this delivering wine. It was a very specific project. We delivered wine. We had this massive, essentially the courier company, Seaborne Express, they had a year's worth of wine sitting in their warehouse that they needed to get out within like 2 weeks. You know, when the president said, right, you can drink, people wanted their wine today. So they had they had a year's worth of supply to just get out as fast as possible. And the stuff was rerouted to the wrong towns. And so they were trying to say sorry in all different ways. We got the job done, but I can remember one of the pilots, I mean, he would come and load up, and he would, you know, we'd put between 30 and 50 different boxes or consignments in the car. And he would sit there meticulously with Google Maps, and he'd plan out his whole route, and that didn't work, and drag this into this order. Okay, now he would spend the extra half an hour before starting to just make sure that this is efficient, because, you know, as I did on day one, you know, you drive out this way and you come back and you go that way, you go back. Ah, oh, I could have gone there first. And, you know, so yeah, you get into it, but certainly there is a bit of preparation required, and people in the aviation industry and the airline industry particularly are good at planning and organizing things quite well.
Yeah, Alex, so just hearing a little bit of your story, and obviously I'm also fortunate enough to be following you on LinkedIn and have been for a while. One thing that stands out is your positive attitude. You've been thrown curveballs even now on your entrepreneurial journey, I'm sure. Would you say that's what's helped you get through this, is to see when something pops up, you just take it head first, or do you think it's something else?
I actually don't know. If I had the answer for that, I think I might have an easier time each day. But certainly my sister seems to think that I always, you know, I'm lucky, you know, things, luck comes my way. And if my toast is going to fall down, it's going to fall down butter side up, which is great. And I'm trying to, you know, every time we talk, she's now in Australia, but every time we talk, I try and unpack this a little more. And you know, what are you really saying here? Like, but essentially you do make your own luck in some respects, but it is also on the back of the timing and what you've been through before. This is an opportunity of what comes. Like, three people could be presented the same set of information and you can do three different things. I think, you know, I come from an entrepreneurial background. My parents divorced, and my father has had several businesses from a whole range of different backgrounds. He's qualified as a civil engineer, but been in makeup and lighting and property and all sorts. And my mother and stepfather, they also had a very successful clothing factory in Cape Town. And both of those from being young, you know, 6, 7 years old, exposed to lots of different businesses. And it has always appealed to me. And ironically, when I left school, I had a year off to just travel. And then when I joined the Air Force, you know, I got through the training and became a pilot and got wings. But I was always just looking for something more. So then I studied and I got a BCom degree. And then I was still just looking for something more. So I did my civilian licenses, my airline transport license. And then even then I got into South African Airways, and I was just always looking for something more. Like I can remember having vivid conversations with people saying, look, this is great and I really enjoy what I'm doing, but there's got to be more. There's got to be. And I think it was this yearning for some kind of a entrepreneurship journey. And I had dabbled with it as a kid, and I had a little ice cream business selling ice creams on the beach in Cape Town as a kid. And various little things. I had I developed a smartphone app a couple of years ago, and I used a lot of the lessons learned there as well. But there was always something that I wanted to do more. But I can tell you that it is a journey of hard knocks, you know, like this. You get good news this morning and you're elated for a couple of days. The good news wears off fairly quickly and you get knocked on the chin tomorrow. And, you know, that can really take the wind out of your sails for, I find, quite a few days. You know, you guys will know the same journey. The entrepreneurial journey is, it's wild. You know, there's, my father always says it's a mix of euphoria and despair. The euphoria doesn't seem to last as long as the despair, but yeah, I think you got to just go after things. And if you see some kind of a pattern, one is like, okay, there's some information. Two, you know, hey, that's interesting that this is the second time I'm hearing that. But the third time, you got to make a go of something.
Yeah, I think my example just on the entrepreneurship is I was chatting to someone the other day, and for me, it's just like a roller coaster, right? Some people enjoy the ups, some people enjoy the downs, but regardless, you're going to have to do the ups and the downs to go back to the start of the roller coaster or just to keep on this journey. Sorry, Simon, you're saying something.
Yeah, no worries. So, I mean, that's like super interesting because it's kind of like a thing we always pose to like entrepreneurs that we have on here. You know, some people are kind of thrust into the entrepreneurial journey, never thought about it. Some people have this. And I think like you stated, you know, you've kind of always had this like building in the back of the mind. So like, I'd be keen to know, I mean, what was the plan that you were, you know, let's call it like the long-term plan pre-COVID, you know, this never happened. Was it always that you're going to be like a SAA pilot, start opening a couple of side hustles? Once the side hustle kicks in, you're going to transition into entrepreneurship? Or, I mean, like, did you have some sort of long-term plan like that?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. You know, I was actually in the middle of things. A couple of things kind of lined up in my favor. Again, my sister would say I'm lucky. And a couple of things that I had to just repurpose. So I was getting involved in public speaking, and on the back of this LinkedIn, you know, I had a significant following, which was fascinating for me. I was just sharing the things that it was enjoyable for me about what I was doing at work, and people seemed to enjoy it. So I carried on, and people started reaching out then and saying, listen, I love the stories. Can you come out to give a talk at my offices? I said, well, sure. I mean, I can do that, but I'm going to have to charge you because it's my time now. And that built into public speaking, which was great. And I was gearing up for that. And being an SAA pilot, you know, you get rebate tickets. I could travel the world. So the market for motivational speaking, that kind of a gig in the United States is huge. It's a profession. I mean, I think anything you can think of is a profession in the United States. So it was a journey that I was moving towards. And even an entry-level person doing motivational speaking in the States, you can, you know, one or two gigs a month, you're making real money. So I was trying to hone the craft, build up a plan. And I gave myself 6 to 12 months to try and maybe just land a couple of gigs there, go on a flight out there, do a gig, get into the market and feel my way around. And if I could see within a few months that some momentum growing, then, you know, having chatted with the family, we're going to transition out of this airline lifestyle, which offered a lot of opportunities, but I was getting quite tired at the time of it. And, you know, it was a distinct possibility. And at the same time, I was getting more gigs here, getting booked and paid. But those two things all got shut down at the same time. You know, the public speaking and travel at the same time was a tough double blow. So yeah, it was part of the plan.
And then, I mean, the transition after that, because I think it's like it's testament to entrepreneurship where, you know, you kind of think, how many steps ahead do I need to be planning for? Because I think a lot of people would say, okay, cool, like I've got my main gig, and then my backup, like you said, would be the public speaking. But like often you don't really think that there should be like a step three, step four, step five. And potentially that's what COVID's teaching us, is that, you know, you kind of need to have these backup plans. And like you've said, you know, obviously you got these signs. So, I mean, what then typically happened that it's kind of like you take one major blow, okay, I can't fly anymore. There's zero jobs for me. My backup plan has gone for chalk now because there's no public speaking. So like what was going through your mind then? Because I'd imagine that like the third backup plan is something that you're not traditionally thinking. You kind of like, I've got my safety net, but now the safety net, you know, oaks were cutting holes in it. And as you fell on the safety net, you've fallen straight through.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'd like to think I had a safety net. Quite frankly, I didn't have a safety net, you know. I think it's a common trap. Well, I tell myself this. I'll tell you my experience. You know, we lived a decent lifestyle. The lifestyle of an international airline pilot is fairly good. The pay is fairly good. But you know, when you're in those lifestyle, you tend to live it up more than you should. So we didn't operate in a frugal way, and we had no safety nets. So it was a serious blow to have no paycheck from one day to the next. It would be nice to have had 6 months in the bank and could take it easy, and you know, but that wasn't our case. So it was really a case of go after something now and make a plan quickly. But yeah, I mean, I don't know if I've ever really have plan C, D, and E, 3, 4, and 5. You know, at the moment I've got 2 or 3 or 4 different sort of avenues that I'm involved in. One of them being podcasting as well. You know, this is why it's an enjoyable conversation for me with you guys, because I'm in the same boat, and yeah, you guys are testament to this as well. It's not a money-making venture. It's a bit of a passion. You know, you don't get into podcasting because you want to become a millionaire overnight.
Unless you're Joe Rogan.
Yeah. And then again, it takes you 10 or 12 years, and you have to be a stand-up comedian. You have to be on TV beforehand. You have to have Netflix specials. So it's not the journey that you go on to make money, but it offers something, you know, and every little bit helps with public speaking, having a podcast. I think at least people can hear what you sound like. That's a good start. You know, it's a bit like an advert. When you want to get out there with public speaking, say, well, here's my podcast. If you want to reach some guest for your podcast, they might become a client. So, you know, those kind of things work nicely together.
I just want to ask, Alex, because it's actually been on my mind this week, but they say as entrepreneurs, you really should focus on one business and put all your eggs in that basket and give all your effort and your time. And it's quite interesting how you've said now, I think you said 4 or 5 different ventures going on right now. How do you manage each of them and make sure that you're giving all your effort to each one?
Well, I mean, firstly, you got to have a good team. So one of the great guests I had on my show, Jeff Hoffman, multiple billionaire inventor, businessman. And, you know, he says, you pick a good team and you get out of the way and you let them carry on. So one of the things I did from the journey last year in the telecoms, the digital care, was to say from the beginning, give the team as much autonomy as possible. And I mean, not quite self-sorting, but, you know, a very much open door policy, but more than that, guys, you can try anything. I don't mind you trying stuff and it failing and, you know, you get egg in your face. Just come tell me where went wrong so that we can prevent the other teams from doing that. Or if you do something, you tried and it works, give us the lessons so that we can put them in the other team. So very much open and honest with the team, saying, look, guys, I don't have the answers. I got no industry domain here. We're trying something. I've worked with people, I've worked in teams. I can help you on that front. But as far as the technical skills of doing the job, you guys will probably be the expert. So, you know, so do what you think you do and bring me suggestions and let's see what we can implement. Let's see how we can make the team better. And if you can treat each division or each team or each product and service in that kind of way, you'll obviously have to identify some kind of team leaders of each of the little groups, but they kind of, you start noticing them quite quickly and they'll rise to the top and you can put people in charge of groups of people. You know, you can't manage 45 people by yourself, but you can have 3 team leaders and the 3 team leaders can work with you a bit more closely. And so that's the approach, really, was to say, give them as much autonomy as possible and allow them to either shine or you know, cause trouble and repair themselves.
And I mean, in terms of their journey, because I think that's really inspirational, is a lot of times as entrepreneurs, I think you find yourself in a position where, and we've chatted with guests about this before, it's like, if I don't do it, it's not going to be done right. And I think that's really inspirational, especially in the entrepreneurship journey, is realizing that, you know, when you surround yourself with the right team and the right mix and whatever, you can give the capability to give that across to your team members. And then by giving them control, like you say, now it's actually taking you away from the, like, you know, your core focus isn't there. You're allowing other people to grow this, you know, animal for you. And then that gives you the ability to pivot from there and then focus on another business, bring more people in. And I think that, yeah, like I say, I mean, maybe that's kind of like a question is, you know, is that something that you learned in like the airline industry? Because I think there, as a pilot, there's a lot of trust that you place in the technician did actually bolt the wing on. Like, I'm going to take this thing off and the wing's not going to fall off mid-flight. Like, there is actually fuel that's been pumped into the, you know, the plane.
It's interesting how you phrase that now, Simon, because you know, I talk about trust a lot in the speaking that I do. And trust is obviously very important all over aviation, but, you know, representing the Silver Falcons and the display flying, that's really the story I talk about trust. I've got some cool photos and videos and people like to relate. But I guess from the beginning, and I've been involved in aviation since I was 18, 19, you grow into the industry like any other industry. There's certain things that take place. And in aviation, from the first time you get into an airplane, you haven't met the technician. You haven't seen the work he's done. You haven't talked the spanner. You haven't, you know, tested, well, you'll check the fuel and oil, but you haven't tested the tire pressure. There's a lot of things that require trust from that first lesson. And I don't know if many other industries certainly don't have it to the degree that you needed in aviation. So I suppose it was just inculcated from such a young age, from day one, that you, when someone says they're doing their job, well, then they're doing their job. And there's checks and balances in places to make sure that the when they say they've done it, they have done it. And usually it's in the form of like an artisan will sign off the work actually done, wheel changed, and a supervisor will say, I confirm and I've checked it myself. And by the time I get to the airplane, you know, I'm doing a pre-flight on the airplane. It's come out of a servicing. Two people have signed it. It's now been pre-flighted by a technician. And then I also pre-flighted. So there's four opportunities to have a look at this aircraft. And it's been signed off on three of those occasions. You know, do I want to go and double check the work again for the fourth time and sign it off again before I then decide to take it? So that trust really has to get built in early. And I think the animal is too big that I don't have the capacity to go and check a whole bunch of things. You know, just on an airplane, there's three different types of technician that could work, you know, airframes, engine, and avionics. If you've got a radio snag, you're not going to call the same guy who's going to give you assistance with the engine that's giving you trouble. So I think it must have just come from so early, and the industry has been built on that. And certainly when you get to airliners flying, you know, the Airbus 350, the latest modern, most modern airliner in the world. I mean, sure, those things are complex. So you got to just build in what you can from trust. And I suppose I just built that into my team, saying, well, John, if you say you're going to do it, then you do it. Cool. I'll leave you with it. Tell me when it's done. Or you say it's going to be done. When are you going to do it? Tomorrow? Great. Give it to me tomorrow.
Yeah.
That's kind of the approach I took.
And is there a specific test that you do for your employees in trust, or is exactly like you just said, where John promises to do something and as long as he delivers, all good?
Okay. So we're not building airplanes. not getting airborne with people either. In terms of screening and choosing the right people, yes. You know, when we employed them, but then getting the job done, it's more like, well, we're going to then, once you've gone through the screening and we've interviewed you and we like you and we employ you, then we're going to give you the trainings required to get the job done. And even if after the training, it wasn't sufficient for you for some reason, either you didn't like the style of instruction, or there was one particular area that needed more work, we'll give you more work. And even on the job, you know, you struggle, we'll help you on the job. So I think there's enough steps in place along the way to assist people to say, if you battle, just say, hey. And what I do with my team is, I think it's become a bit of a joke, is that I just admit I make a lot of mistakes, because I do. I make a lot of mistakes. So just about every message I send to the team is that, listen, guys, I make a lot of mistakes. So if I've made a mistake on your pay slip, or I paid you the wrong amount, or whatever, just let me know, you know, let's fix it. So I just kind of be very open and honest with the team from the beginning. And that's continued all the way along.
Awesome. And I mean, I think that's like so inspirational, you know, to go from, call it like airline pilot to courier driver, to, you know, now chatting around you, you've got a team around you. And I mean, in terms of that time frame, because I would imagine, you know, when you're a courier driver, it's like you say, massive wake up call to work all those long hours. You're making just over 200 bucks. Yeah. Like, I think you sit there and go like, whoa, you know, that conversation of there's more to life was probably playing louder than the radio could. So, I mean, in terms of like the career journey, like how did you, you know, what was that pivotal moment that made you decide, okay, great. And, you know, potentially what was that next thing that you decided to get involved in, you know, now that public speaking was gone, the pilot industry was gone. And I could imagine you didn't want to be a career guy for an extended amount of time.
Well, yeah. So that first day driving was, it was actually a lot of fun, because we'd all been locked up for, I don't know if it was 6 or 8 weeks by then. And it was actually just nice to just get out on the road. I've got my, Joe Rogan in the ears, 12 hours on the road. It was actually quite nice. I even bumped into a fellow pilot, driving through one area in Midrand, and that was quite nice to see her. And we had a little chat at the intersection for a few seconds, but it was quick. And again, going back to the posting on LinkedIn, I put a post on the day that I set out that first morning. I looked quite smart and I had my Hivers jacket, and you can see a boot full of boxes of wine. I don't drive a very fancy car. I've got a very small Yaris hatchback. It can't really load too much, but I had 38 boxes to deliver, and about my business, 38 boxes of 6 bottles of wine. So it was a lot of wine to deliver, and took pride in the job and polished my shoes and got ready for work. I actually enjoyed the interaction with the people. It goes back to the podcast as well. When not everyone was there, it was some delivery person or a housekeeper or a gate guard or whoever. But when the person was there, I'd take sometimes, I remember one guy at a petrol station, it was his own business, and he chose that delivery. I think we spoke for 45 minutes just talking about business, talking about life. And I really enjoyed the people interaction. So, it was a wake up call, but, because I took a photo of this post again, that post had received a lot of feedback. And on the back of that, I realized, listen, there's something here bigger than me delivering wine, and not from a point of view that I don't want to just deliver wine anymore, but I think I could do something more. And it was really exciting for me to try and recruit that first bunch of people. I think after that first day, I realized, then I posted the picture, and then the next day, and then by the end of the next day, I realized, whoa, something's happening here. I've got so many, and I had to start a whole new email address just to receive applications. And I had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people wanting to just get involved, and all over the country. Obviously, I was only in Gauteng at the time, but that was exciting to screen through people and build a team. And the next Monday I had a bunch of people arriving here, and we set up okay, guys, this is what you're going to do. And remember to send this message, and I had to build a system. There was no system. And essentially a WhatsApp group built this company from nothing. And, here we are about 18 months later, and the company's still going. And at the moment we've got a regular about 10 people a week who are looking after their families. They're not delivering wine anymore, but they're more actively involved within the courier business, not like an ad hoc project. They kind of day to day. So that's also nice that you could build something out of nothing, and you could also provide that was a real, that was really enjoyment for me. I don't know what you guys think about on the entrepreneurial journey, but to provide for other people was great. And I mean, at the peak earlier this year, I had about 75 people on the two different projects. And, from one respect, it's very stressful. It's thinned down quite a lot now, but it was very exciting for me to know that 75 families are better off today from nothing.
Yeah, I think it's definitely one of the more enjoyable things for me as being an entrepreneur as well. It's just hiring people, helping. And that's obviously why I'm asking the questions I am, because around the trust thing, it is difficult. But my next question is going to go, and it points directly to your podcast. And for those of you that don't know the name of it, but it is called High Performance Teams. And now you've just spoken us through the career business and how you had to get all these applications. Was it always your aim and objective that this becomes a high performance team? Did you do certain things to ensure, when you said, I think now it was 75 people working for you, was it a high performing team? Would you say, did you do certain things to do that? Or was it just scramble, this thing is making income, we got lots of deliveries, let's just get people on the road?
Well, it was interesting. I mean, yeah, the goal would always be that you build something the best you can, and whether it's a team or whatever it is, the team must be a good team. So I just want to separate the two things. So the one is involved in the courier business continues, and the other one in a digital care on the sort of telecom space also continues, but they are quite separate, and they sort of equal in size now, and we kind of shrunk a little bit. But certainly on the digital side, on the customer care experience and the project management that we did, it was, we did try and recruit, and this speaks to the industry again. So based on a couple of quick conversations, there was a need then to, again, when the wine said go, when the president said go, the wine could be delivered, there was a backlog and they needed to sort it out. Well, the same thing happened with work from home, school from home, telecoms, business was booming. They really had a lot of interest, and everyone wanted to up the internet at home from a 10 meg line, not suitable anymore. So business was booming in the order of 400-500% up. but customer care didn't track with that. Just like, okay, well, we've got a year's worth of wine to get out, but we can't get it to people fast enough because we don't have enough drivers. So in a similar way, there was a marryover. But I went to market quite quickly, and I used LinkedIn as the place to find the people. And at the same time, Flight Center had just had a major hiccup, and they were just about closing down the business. So I had a lot of people that came in from the aviation game. I mean, I had a whole range, but the biggest single source was Flight Center. And because of the right one or two people that heard it, they'd called in a few friends. And I think at some point, I had something like 8 or 9 employees just from Flight Center alone. And I don't know if you ever worked with somebody from Flight Center or if you've gone to try and get a ticket, but those people know how to work hard. They're not scared of hard work. They're diligent, they're hardworking, they're thorough, and they go after things, and they're typically commission-based. So the business was kind of built around a commission-based approach. And so that de-risked me, but it also de-risked the client because I could only invoice if the work was complete. Similarly, I could only pay my staff if they did work. So, or, you know, you do work, I can invoice, I can pay you. So kind of the whole thing was a very novel way of doing things. And it worked out quite well. But it did filter for itself, you know. You work harder, you earn more. So, yeah, we obviously had a bit of a turnover as well. But certainly that one place of Flight Center being quite instrumental in the success of where we got to. We got to quite high heights quite quickly. And you know, one of the projects didn't really last so long. But certainly I've had a taste of what it can be and what the team are capable of. And we actively hunting down another client that could reach those same, you know, reap the benefit of a team that knows how to work hard.
Brilliant. Yeah, I think that's exciting. And one thing I'm picking up, and again, you know, going to pose a question if it's potentially from like your airline days, but one thing that I'm picking up is you obviously got a lot of attention to call it, I can't say like things that are coming up ahead, but you're looking at the horizon, you're adjusting to that and you're coping. And I would imagine being a pilot, that's exactly what you do. You know, you're flying this aircraft, you see a storm up ahead, you adjust the path, you're still moving forward, but you're always, you know, scanning the horizon. And I think that's one thing I'm picking up from you, which I think is really incredible, is, you know, kind of you're always scanning the horizon. If you see a gap, you're attacking the gap, you know, going ahead from there and chasing. And I think that's kind of testament to being an entrepreneur, is, you know, you need to look what's coming ahead, scan the horizon, check, and then, you know, adjust your course and kind of attack it from there.
Yeah, I think there's definitely some merit in that. And again, it's one of the stories that I share. Sounds like you got the script. But
yeah, like the inside scoop, yeah.
But certainly, you know, scanning the horizon, you know, an airliner at 80 miles, that's 10 minutes. So that's, you know, 130, 150 kilometers away. If you see a storm, because you're traveling so fast, once the storm's at like 40 miles, it's almost too late to start turning now, because you're not going to get the momentum. Is a bit like a big ship, you know, you need to get the rate of change, the nose needs to get out, and then you need to sort of accelerate in another direction. So yes, you do sort of predict further in advance. Obviously you do your planning before you go, but in the flight, you're scanning the weather radar, and that first sign of the stuff coming across the 160 mile, you know, when you start noticing, you start paying attention, because it's less than 20 minutes away. And when it gets to about 80 miles, you actually have to have a plan in place. You can't, and I don't know what it relates to in software for you. Maybe you could share a little bit about software, but you got to develop now, and you work in these little sprints, whether it's a week or 2 weeks, 3 week sprints, but you also got to have one eye on the idea for what's coming next. Like, you can't plan the next platform. You can't plan the next sort of evolution in software, but you have to know, A, I'm going to finish this project, but B, what's coming around the corner? Like, what is your experience, Simon?
Yeah, 100%. I think that's, you know, critical. I mean, in terms of what we do, so we do ERP systems, you know, you're typically looking at 6 to 8 months implementation. And I think that's kind of where the critical mass comes in, because when you're looking at from like a resourcing point of view, exactly like you say, you know, when you're committing to a project, you kind of know for 6 to 8 months you committed. But when those 6 to 8 months are over, you need to have something in place to keep those resources on. But then it becomes that like fine balance, because too much and kind of the ship's going to fall over, because then you don't have enough people. But then also you don't have 25 people on the team. You've got one project, and then, you know, you don't land anything after that. And then you've kind of got a resource intense. So I think that's from like a resource point of view. And I think also scanning the horizon, which a lot of the times people don't realize, is you need to be thinking a couple of steps ahead. So we talk a lot about it in the industry with like digital transformation. And, you know, clients are always looking at like what's happening. I mean, you look at the software trends. iPhone's like a perfect example. You know, you purchase an iPhone today, within a month, there's like a brand new iPhone with the latest, greatest features, new camera, new software, updated memory. So the thing is to try always keep ahead of that. Like, it is difficult, but you need to always be focused on that. So what is happening in terms of artificial intelligence? What's happening in terms of automation, etc.? But I think the most critical thing that we draw away from the software industry is it's always great to look ahead, but I also need to look at what's relevant for me. So, and, you know, the way that I kind of look at that is, you know, if we relate it back to like the airline industry, if you see a little cloud ahead and it's not a rainstorm or it's nothing of danger, you're not now going to divert the plane 200 kilometers. It's kind of like, well, there's no danger. You know, we can kind of go through this. But if there's a hailstorm, I need to adjust that. And I think that's exactly the same what we do in the software industry. We're always scanning the horizon, but we're always seeing what makes sense for customers. Some customers want artificial intelligence. They want the automation. Other customers don't want it. Other customers just want your software to process a transaction. Give me a dashboard at the end of the day and I'm happy with that, you know? So, yeah.
You're using so many buzzwords that come out in my talks again. Yeah. It's like, it's really, this isn't scripted, but let me share a little story. I'll share the short version of, you know, one of the bits that I do in the talk is that exactly the scan the horizon, but what industry, you know, such as yourselves do not so well, is, and what the aviation industry can perhaps share, and I like to share specifically, is this idea of flight and duty. Now, it's very well regulated. I think aviation is the most regulated industry in the world. Now, I mean, you can go anywhere, any airline, and you can tell that, you know, you're going to work this day, not that day. You're going to work from here. If you fly this long, you need a third pilot. If you fly that, you need the fourth pilot, and you're going to do a recurrency training every 6 months. You're going to do this, and the it's documented. There's no, you don't just sort of jump into an airline and you're a pilot. There's a plan. There's a plan for every single day of the year. Your life is broken down into hours and minutes. You know, a flight for me to Munich would be, you know, it'll be 22 hours and 47 minutes. Time away from base will be somewhere like 74 hours and 33 minutes. You know, it's documented to that much detail. And what they do together with that is to say, well, when did your flight end? And you need so many hours and minutes and days off between that flight and the next flight. So I know as a pilot that if I'm going to go to Europe, you know, South African Airways up and down, I'm going to operate for 4 days, I'm going to go up on day one, land on day two, rest on the second half of day two, rest on the first half, day three, and the day three evening, I'm going to fly back home on day four, and then I'm going to have 3 days off afterwards. You know, they're not going to phone me. Nothing's going to happen to me between that flight and the next flight where I go off to New York. Same thing. It's a 5 day trip and I go off on day one, land on day two, et cetera. So after every flight, there's a defined off period. So Joburg to Munich, I'll be off in Munich for about 33 hours. So I know that, again, nothing's going to happen to me. I must rest and be ready for the flight home. That's my duty. I can do what I like there. Obviously, you know, you want to be healthy and you can't disappear out of the town. But you've got to be ready and fresh and ready for and prepared for work the next day. So A to B, I know I'm going to rest. And after B to A, I'm going to have a bit of a longer rest. So there's time off after a leg, time off after a flight, time off after a chunk of time. And that, I think that's somewhere like, you work in projects and you say you got this project lined up. It's a 6 month project, but you got to have that next project lined up. And you can't have too many people on the ship, otherwise it might sink. But let's say you do have that next project lined up and it's a juicy one and it's almost better than the previous one. And the guys sign off with whatever, Wits Business School. And Monday morning, they join up with Engine. And now you're on this new project. And that's another 4 or 5 months. And you sign off with Engine. And the next thing, I've got a project with Coca-Cola rolling out. There's no off time. There's no like planned off time. And it really is something that the guys could do a lot better. And take a leaf out of the aviation industry's book and say, look, you know, there's a defined period where you work hard and there's a defined period where you rest. And really it's to do with safety. You know, humans can't operate the way we'd, you know, if you've got some people working for you, you want them to work around the clock. If you're the person working, you want to work as little as possible. And somewhere in the middle is the truth. So if I go into Munich, I know that this is an 11-hour flight and I'm going to be really tired, but let's focus, guys. We're going to land this plane, just like you guys are going to land the project. But we'll know we have some time off afterwards. We'll regroup and come back to work bright-eyed and bushy-tailed for the next one.
Yeah.
I just want to ask, because it's obviously quite interesting how you are back being in the pilot and everything was planned and meticulous. So just one quick question. I know we are running out a bit of time, but did you do something? I'm not sure 100% sure which BCom you did, but did you do a SWOT analysis on your businesses? Did you have this 20-page document that was a business plan? How did it all just play out in your mind? I know you mentioned with the customer care business, it was just a couple of conversations. So was there a plan in place?
No, really. They wanted a WhatsApp call center to be manned by 50 people. And we started with 25 and we started with 20 and put another 20 in. And we actually never did the thing that they asked us to do in the beginning. We did about four or five other things. You know, we started with one line item and eventually I think we were invoicing 11 different line items and that's scaled all the way back again now. But no, there was a basic, well, from what I hear you saying, I will send you this document. And then, okay, we need to update it and change a few things. So it was a bit of a back and forth with what I thought they needed to see on paper. But no, there was no proper SWOT analysis. It was more a case of, I'm ready. I can assemble a team. When do you want them to start? We'll figure it out as we go. And I think that's really the point in terms of like sort of business. People get lost in these ideas of, you know, if you were to ask me what's the one thing that you need to do as an entrepreneur to get going, it is to just literally get going, just start. Agreed. Like there's nothing that's more pertinent than starting. Because if you want to figure out your business name, your business cards, your website, who's your customer and all that stuff first, I can promise you it's going to change by the time week three rolls around. As I told you, you know, we didn't even do the thing that I spent 6 weeks preparing for. We still to this day have not done that. Initial conversation and all the conversations until we started was based on this WhatsApp group. We've never done a WhatsApp group.
So it's crazy. Yeah.
If I'd put all the effort into that and maybe I even used a WhatsApp image or used WhatsApp in the business name, it would have been a bit of a farce. So I think the point is just start, course correct as you go.
Awesome. Yeah, I think that's like really powerful what you say. I mean, I've recently been doing a course in strategic innovation for organizations. And I think like the lessons you can learn and what I'm picking up a lot of the time here is I think you need to know as an entrepreneur where to apply certain things. So one thing like I picked up with the strategic innovation is they give you all these graphs, early adopter, late adopter, and there's this chasm, and the chasm is when you're moving from a niche market to a mass market and you need to clearly define that. And then once you get that, this strategy. And I think to myself, okay, great, that's really fine. But I mean, if we had to look at that early adopter, late adopter, and put this whole business model and stuff in place, I mean, if we had to look at the timelines from you leaving SAA to becoming a courier guy to manning, you know, this WhatsApp call center, the time that it would have taken you to put this now whole plan and stuff like that in place, you know, pretty much wouldn't make sense. But looking back now, you know, yes, there are certain concepts that you can adapt. Like, okay, great. To focus on the early adopters, I need to just be a very niche model, a very niche product, focus on the core business, attack that, and then run forward. So I think sometimes entrepreneurs, we need to also take a step back, like you say, take the downtime, just focus on, okay, great, what are my next steps? What do I need to do? What do I need to apply? And then I think the true thing of becoming a successful entrepreneur, I always look at it, it's kind of like, how would you call it? It's almost like a chess player. You're kind of sitting back at the board and you kind of need to know at what time do I need to pull the right pieces. A pawn can move in this direction. A queen can move in that direction. A bishop can move in that direction. So as an entrepreneur, I think, like you say, what's critical is don't always get into the space of being busy, busy, busy. Take the time to rest. And then that gives you the ability to know what card to pull at the right time. And then from there, you should, you know, relatively be successful. You're going to flop sometimes, but, you know, again, fail fast and move forward.
Yeah, I think like just to add on what Alex said, it's just for being an entrepreneur, it's just to move the pawn on the chessboard. I think that's our problem is we all have too many ideas and not enough actions. I think we are pressed for time and Alex has already been so generous with us. But Alex, just to finish us off, if you had to say three or five lessons that you've learned from becoming a successful overseas SAA pilot to now running a few businesses, what would those lessons be for our listeners?
Well, I like to share the story of the first thing is you got to be prepared, despite what we've said the last 5 minutes. You know, this as an airline pilot, you know, before I even get ready and packed at home, I'll check the weather, check where I'm going. Is anything going on in that town? So I'm a little kind of loosely prepared. So when I leave for work, I check the weather. When I get to work, I check the weather again. You know, as a crew, we're looking at the weather. While we're flying through the night, we're scanning the weather. We're getting printout updates of the destination weather. So being as prepared as you can be, but not at the expense of starting. Like, I mean, just because I'm not as prepared as I want to be, it doesn't mean we're not going to get airborne. We're going to get airborne. I mean, even if it's snowing at the other side and you can see nothing, we're going to get airborne and we're going to make the best of our, you know, this is the other point is sometimes you get faced with positions where you don't have all the information, but you do have some information. And with the information you have available now, make a decision based on that. And if the information in a couple of hours or days or weeks time, there's more information and you need to review, and by all means review, and you're encouraged to review, you know, regularly, but you have to make a decision in terms of getting the team going. You know, give them as much autonomy as you can, allow them to fail, allow them, show them the side of you that you also fail, because you do. I failed a lot, and be honest about it, and encourage them to fail and encourage them to be honest. Because I think, you know, if you have a policy of trying to keep it as squeaky clean as possible, and people don't want to be seen to be failing, well, they're failing anyway, whether you know about it or not, rather know about it. And I think you gotta build some trust in your team. And, you know, having this interesting conversation about trust with my sister, she's doing a PhD in trust at the moment. And the you got to trust people in their domain. However, you also got to... If you say that we can build a relationship, Simon, Steve, and I, we build a relationship, and in 2 years' time, we're at a point where maybe you jump in an airplane with me because you trust me. Well, you know, why don't we try and fast forward trust as fast as possible? Let's try and build the trust as quick as you can. And that's really where I kind of got to with my team, that give them a chance to either prove themselves or find the limits of their areas and you know, build that trust as quick as you can. And then Brilliant. Get out of their way. Let them carry on. I don't have all the domain knowledge. In fact, I have very little domain knowledge in these industries, but certainly the team have built up good domain knowledge and they've built a good system.
Yeah.
Last thing I want to say is that, you know, having all this entrepreneurial sort of flair and, you know, doing things a bit of a seat of the pants and shoot from the hip. It's interesting that as you alluded to just now, Simon, 6 months, 12 months in, there's a bit of a lull. You start thinking about the systems that you have and you look around, you actually don't really have systems because this thing was patched together quickly in the beginning. Then's a good time to start building systems. You know, it's funny now going back into the 20 years in the aviation game, standard operating procedures, checklists, processes, and all those things. We've spent a lot of effort in the last sort of 4 to 6 months, really kind of establishing ourselves and building those strong structures that you can plug in people into the system and it can continue.
Brilliant. I think before we end it off, I'm going to give all the people, especially in Joburg, this is now coming from a pilot, bonus tip here. What app would you recommend for weather? Because the people in Joburg officially don't have like a good weather app. It tells you it's raining, but it's not. So straight from a pilot, what would you recommend? This is like the bonus tip.
I used to use the Aero Weather app for flying, but since I no longer fly, you know, I had a pro subscription because it gave me some extra features. I actually don't have anything. My brother-in-law gives you more insights to the weather than he's an accountant. But yeah, I use Wind Guru because it gives me different levels of cloud layers and wind. And Aero Weather was certainly one, but then you have to be able to read the sort of pilot speak. So yeah. I'm sorry, I'm going to fail on that one. I'm failing.
Brilliant. No, well, Alex, you know, from Steve and I and, you know, all our listeners at Business and Beers, we just really want to say thank you for the time. I really found the chat really insightful. It's just been incredible to hear your journey, you know, how you've grown, how you've pivoted, what you've learned. And yeah, just thanks so much for opening up and sharing with all our listeners. We will put all the, you know, platforms where people can follow you and all of that. So just before we end off, I mean, what's the best platform if people want to reach out, chat to you? You know, what's the easiest platform that guys can find you?
Yeah, I'm most active. Yeah, thank you. I'm most active on LinkedIn. I mean, I do have Instagram and a website and stuff as well, but LinkedIn's the place where you'll get, if you want to reach out directly, welcome. You can find me there and that's where I deliver all my content. So yeah, I look forward to it. Thanks for your Brilliant. Time. It was great to have this conversation too.
Thanks Brilliant. So much. Cheers.
Thanks. Cheers.